I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. If you watched I Love Lucy back in the 1950s or the Dick Van Dyke Show in the 1960s, Lucy and her husband, Van Dyke, and his wife slept in single beds. Here's a clip from a more recent TV show, Friends, where Ross, played by David Schwimmer, explains to Chandler, played by Matthew Perry, how to share a bed.
Okay, you're in bed. She's over on your side, cuddling. Now, you wait for her to drift off. And then you hug her and roll her over to her side of the bed. And then you roll away. Hug for her. Roll for you.
Well, everyone has their own sleep needs and habits, and sometimes sharing a bed can lead to problems if one person is a snorer or a blanket stealer or a night owl or works the night shift. That's why about 20 to 25% of couples sleep separately from time to time. Today on Radio Times, we explore this phenomenon and what it all means, and we have two guests who have joined us. David Randall is the author of a book called Dreamland, Adventures in the Strange Science of Sleep. He's a senior reporter at Reuters and was a guest on Radio Times talking about that book. And David Randall, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Also with us is Wendy Troxell, and she's a behavioral and a social scientist at the RAND Corporation, also an adjunct professor of psychiatry and psychology at the University of Pittsburgh. She's also a licensed clinical psychologist and certified behavioral sleep medicine specialist. And Wendy Troxell, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
David, let me begin with you. And I remember interviewing you about your book and your kind of strange sleeping habits. How are things going for you today?
It's actually a little bit better. If you don't know my backstory, basically I started sleepwalking. I walked into a wall. I went to my doctor and said, you know, what can I do? And he basically told me, you know, science doesn't really know that much about sleep. So I thought, you know, why don't we know more? It seems pretty basic. So I went out to basically find out everything I could about sleep. In terms of sleeping myself, I not only do I walk into walls, I kick, I talk, I sing, pretty much any verb you can think of, and add sleep in front of it, I've pretty much done it.
So, do you sleep with your wife?
Does she sleep with you? Yeah, she has much more patience than I probably would if it was a reverse situation. It's amazing what someone can get used to and how quickly someone can say, you know what, you kicked me, but I still love you.
Very nice. Wendy, let me turn to you. And you have looked at couples that sleep together, that sleep apart. And I was frankly surprised to read that something like 20 to 25% of couples sleep separately. Maybe there are times they do sleep together. But is this something new that we're talking about?
Well, I think it's something new that we're talking about in part because for so long it was a taboo to talk about the marital bed. And in fact, there was very little science around it as well, which is kind of where I came in, kind of recognizing, well, the vast majority of adults do actually sleep with a partner most of the time. So about 60 to 65% of U.S. adults regularly sleep with a partner. Now, some of them may occasionally sleep apart. But for the past 50 to 60 years of sleep research, we've focused on sleep from a science perspective as an individual behavior. So, you know, this is a new trend to start bringing some science to the question. And by doing that, I think we're starting to open up the dialogue, and maybe people are kind of coming
out of the closet
to acknowledge that, yes, you know, sometimes I can't sleep with my partner. And there's a lot of concern that, wow, does this mean doom and gloom for the relationship? And it doesn't necessarily mean that by any means. Sometimes couples make choices that work for them, and it's not always sleeping together.
And is it the kind of things that David Randall was describing that he does, or that, you know, the really loud snorer or the person that tosses and turns at night? Are those some of the reasons, Wendy, that people choose to sleep separately?
Absolutely. I mean, sleep disorders are a major culprit that sleep disorders of lots of varieties, kind of the strange behaviors at night that David was talking about, as well as kind of the more common ones, such as sleep apnea and insomnia. These are definitely issues that just cause couples to feel like that they're incompatible with their bed partner because sleeping together causes one or both of them to sleep worse.
I'm just curious about, are there more sleep problems, or we're just studying it more, or people are talking more about the terrible night's sleeps that they have, Wendy? And then I'll get back to you, David.
Well, I mean, sleep disorders are very common. I think we're talking about it more, but there is also a rise in sleep disorders, particularly things like sleep apnea, which is, you know, kind of associated with the loud snoring, gasping for air at night. And part of one of the major culprits that's causing the rise in sleep apnea is also our rising obesity in U.S. and kind of around the globe. So that's a major reason why the prevalence of sleep disorders, of certain sleep disorders, are increasing.
Well, going back to you, David, and even some of the things that you have been writing about people sharing beds or not, when you look at the history of I guess the family or the marital bed, it's gone from the bed where everybody slept together. I certainly remember from those 50s and 60s TV shows when it was, I guess, against the law or against the Hayes Amendment to have people on TV in beds together. Help us understand, I guess, the evolving bed situation.
So beds so much were not just linked with, you know, who you're sharing the bed with. For a long time, it was also the idea of hygiene, if you can believe it. In the Victorian era, you know, they started discovering things like radio waves and the idea that there's all these unseen forces that are at work. They didn't necessarily, you know, science didn't really have the understanding of germ theory as we know it now. So there was this idea that if you were sharing a bed with somebody, they could, you know, basically zap what were called your vital forces at night, whether it was through, you know, the breath or just being in close contact. So there's idea that saying, you know, it's more hygienic to have twin beds, and those beds should be metal because, you know, wood might be a little suspect as well. So that was kind of the background of why there were, you know, I Love Lucy, there were two separate beds. That carried over into the, you know, 40s, 50s, and 60s. It was in the 60s when there was idea that, you know, we're evolving. There should be couples were thought at the same, you know, you really should share a bed because that's the idea of, you know, you have intimacy, you have a strong relationship. And that was also when, you know, until the 1960s or so, there was a code for television that said basically that you couldn't show couples sharing a bed together. And if two couples were in a bed together, one person had to have a firm foot on the floor. So there's not even a suggestion of a, you know, horizontality that could happen. So that, you know, then after the 60s, there was this idea of, wait a minute, if I'm not sharing a bed, then maybe something's wrong with me. People I spoke with who, you know, said at that time, they actually really liked having separate beds. And then they kind of felt forced back into one bed. And then they had to deal with, you know, their husband snoring or kicking or somebody stealing the covers. And it was all these other things that were outside just the literal physical part of, I like to sleep without somebody kicking me, that entered the conversation.
Well, going back to you, Wendy, I mean, it's interesting that if people are feeling like they have a choice now, and I would assume you would suggest as a psychologist that people talk about this stuff, not that it just sort of happen, but that it be part of a conversation.
Absolutely. I mean, it's just amazing to me to think of all the behaviors to be prescribed to us by what society tells us we should do. It makes no sense that obviously there are individual differences and couple-level differences. And this is a really intimate, shared experience, and couples should dialogue as a unit away from kind of the influences of what they think that they should be doing, what society is telling them to do, because obviously the pendulum has swung in society from the Victorian era, as David discussed, into the I Love Lucy era, to the 60s and beyond, where it became the shift towards the marital bed is this meaningful and powerful thing, and if you don't ascribe to that that behavior as a couple, then there's inherently something wrong with your couple, and it's just not the case. Couples who are healthy are able to negotiate all sorts of things in an open and honest way that acknowledges their, you know, personal preferences and what works for them as a couple unit, not what works for everybody else.
Do we have research, Wendy, to say whether people sleep better or worse if they sleep together?
Well, there's a small number of studies that have looked at this, and somewhat surprisingly to me, actually, it's not all that surprisingly, when we look at couples who sleep together versus apart, and if we measure their sleep using objective means, and most of the time it's been using activity monitor, which basically when you're sleeping, you move less. And what these studies have shown is that when couples sleep together versus when they sleep alone, they actually sleep worse. That is, they have more movements at night when they're with their partner as compared to when they sleep alone. But the funny thing is, when you ask those same people, do you sleep better subjectively with your partner or when you sleep alone? Subjectively, they'll say that the quality of their sleep was better when they slept with their partner.
Does that make sense?
What this suggests is that it's really those kind of psychological feelings of safety and security that matter even more than kind of any objective costs of sleeping with a partner.
Does that make sense to you, David?
Definitely. I've spoke with people too, and it was essentially there's a conflict between the heart and the head. You know, the body really likes sleeping by yourself because you get all these benefits. The studies, you know, Wendy was talking about, people spend about half an hour longer in the deeper, more restorative stages of sleep when they're sleeping alone. But they tend to like to sleep with somebody else because they have all these other issues that go into sleep. You know, if you're sharing a bed with somebody, some people describe it to me as almost essentially as the backstage of life. You know, you could share moments with them, that feeling of comfort. And then, you know, for some couples too who have had health issues, they actually feel safer sleeping with somebody next to them, even if they're not necessarily sleeping as well, because, you know, what happens if they have, go into diabetic shock or they start, you know, some other thing that could happen there in the middle of the night, they're scared to be alone.
Well, and I wonder too, Wendy, people are so busy, whether that time alone in bed is sort of the rare moment that a couple has together.
Absolutely. I mean, I work with couples a lot who have different sleep schedules because of work or personal preferences. And what I think is so important, even if your sleep schedules themselves are incompatible, or even if you choose to sleep apart, it's sometimes that time in bed together when you're not sleeping that is the most precious time, because it's one of the few times when couples are alone together, kind of away from all the other distractions of their lives, if they allow their bedroom to be that. Now, the problem is many couples bring all sorts of distractions into the bedroom, so we have to work on that too, technology being one of the major factors there. But yes, that time in bed when it's just the two of you, I think that that's really this crucial time when couples really get to kind of be a couple.
Well, let's take a very short break, and I do want to talk about those distractions you just mentioned. That's Wendy Troxell. She's a behavioral and social scientist at the RAND Corporation, also an adjunct professor of psychiatry and psychology at the University of Pittsburgh, a licensed clinical psychologist, and if that weren't enough, a certified behavioral sleep medicine specialist. We are talking about couples sharing and not sharing the bed. Also with us, David Randall, author of a book called Dreamland, Adventures in the Strange Science of Sleep. He's also a senior reporter at Reuters. We want to hear from you. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia, and we're talking about the trials, the tribulations, the challenges, and the benefits of sharing your bed with someone else. Again, our guests are David Randall and Wendy Troxell. I want to play another scene from another TV show. This is from How I Met Your Mother. Marshall and Lily discuss the idea of separate beds and then a third one. Marshall is played by Jason Segel, and Lily is played by Allison Hannigan. Let's listen.
I don't think human beings were ever meant to sleep in the same bed. Somehow sex and sleep got all jumbled together, but they're two different things.
I know. I mean, I love you, but I want this new bed to be a sanctuary for sleep and sleep alone.
Me too. And some light snacking, but that's it. Hey, you know what we should get? We should get a third bed just for sex.
Again, a scene from How I Met Your Mother. We're talking with Wendy Troxell. She's a certified behavioral sleep medicine specialist, and David Randall, who's written a book about sleeping, the strange science of sleep, as he calls it. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. I do want to talk about the sex part, but let me talk about the distraction part and even crumbs in the bed. And to you, David, one of the things that you looked at are all the things that have been hauled into the bedroom now that perhaps makes it even harder to sleep.
especially when you think about Netflix, how you can now stream in bed, that what's so distracting about that isn't just the fact that, you know, if you're watching an episode of Breaking Bad, it can be very hard to fall asleep afterwards.
I'll say.
Just because of the emotional part. But then also the light of our you know, TV monitors, our iPads, our iPhones, it's kind of blue. It's bluish white, and our brains aren't developed enough to distinguish that from sunlight, essentially. You know, our brains developed in a world where the sun or the candle was pretty much the brightest thing you were going to see. So you see that brightish white light at night, and it gives a very subtle signal to the brain to stay up a little bit longer. So it can be hard to, you know, really let yourself down and to ease into sleep as easily. And then the other part of technology is, you know, it's a benefit, but the sleep apnea, you know, the treatment, CPAP machines, some people just cannot stand to sleep next to somebody who's wearing one. So that's another reason why somebody says, you know, I need to sleep in a separate room from you.
And that's a mask that someone wears, right, David?
Yeah, it essentially looks like, you know, you're a jet fighter, a fighter pilot. It goes over your nose, goes over your mouth. They're actually a lot better than they used to be. The original ones really were loud and almost sounded like a vacuum cleaner in the middle of the night. Now it's just kind of a whitish noise, white noise essentially. But some people just really cannot stand to have that.
Wendy, I've heard some people say that, you know, the bed is for sex and for sleep and for nothing else. Are you part of that camp?
You know, I think that's a basic part of sleep hygiene, and I wouldn't be quite so prescriptive. I think that keeping things like eating, TV, iPhones, iPads, Androids, all sorts of technology, the better place is outside of the bedroom. The idea being that the bedroom is a haven for sleep, and the more that you allow those things to invade your space, the less present you are if you're sharing a bed with your partner. And if you're not sharing a bed, the less you're allowing your own mind to settle down, to unwind, and to be able to fall into deep, restful sleep. I want to return to that point that David made, though about wearing CPAP.
Yes.
For patients with sleep apnea, because sleep apnea is such a major driver of couples sleeping apart, because one of the predominant symptoms is snoring. So the couples that I have seen, and there's actually some research to show that as kind of non-sexy as a CPAP mask may be, it's better than sleeping with a loud snorer. And when you think about the benefits for your partner in terms of the health benefits for wearing the mask, which many people don't, even when prescribed, and by wearing the mask, they're decreasing their risk for heart disease, among other things. They're also decreasing their fatigue and sleepiness during the day, which can lead to drowsy driving, which is a major cause of motor vehicle accidents. This benefit of wearing a non-sexy thing that does have a noise, many bed partners feel that, again, that wearing the, having their bed partner wear the mask way, the benefits far exceed the downside of wearing a non-sexy mask.
And Wendy, would you say we're generally speaking a sleep-deprived nation? Do we scrimp on our sleep?
We are a almost wholly sleep-deprived nation, and really since the advent of light, as David described, we've really kind of messed with our sleep schedules, which used to be dependent on the natural daylight schedules. Now we have the capacity to work literally 24/7 and to have light signals influencing our brain and keeping us awake, and all of this technology which and demands from, you know, our work, our families, the outside world, that really can keep us awake and 24/7. And it's been a long time, you know, for a long time, being sleep deprived was almost a badge of honor in our society, and in specific parts of our society, such as the military or in medicine. And it's only kind of more recently when there's been this vast research showing how detrimental lack of sleep or sleep disturbances are to our physical and mental well-being, that the dialogue is changing, too, about kind of, well, is being sleep deprived really such a badge of honor, or is it something we need to systematically address as a society?
David, I remember you talking about back in the olden days, the people generally slept 2 4-hour periods. Now we think you need 6, 7, 8 hours of continuous sleep, but that always wasn't the case with human beings.
No, so essentially, we've kind of tricked ourselves into thinking that we need consolidated sleep. You know, if I don't get 7 or 8 hours straight, something's wrong. There have been studies, though, that interestingly show that if you isolate somebody away from natural light, if you just kind of put them essentially outside of the sun rotation, light and day cycle, that they'll fall asleep, around 10 o'clock or so when the sun should be, when it's dark. They'll wake up naturally about 1 or so, and they'll stay awake for about an hour, maybe an hour and a half, and then they'll fall back asleep. Huh. And there's been research that shows that this was the sleep pattern that people had, 1600s, 1500s, before there were street lights, before there were gas lights. And there was a term for it. It was called, the first sleep and the second sleep. And that time in between was actually thought of as a very restful time, a very, contemplative time. You could share your thoughts with somebody else. You could just think about your dreams, think about what was happening the next day. And what happens now is that a lot of people naturally wake up at 1 or 2 in the morning and they think, oh, my God, I'm awake in the middle of the night. Something's wrong. I need to take an Ambien. I need to take something else. So they start medicating a condition that just comes standard with the human body.
I have a tweet from Joe I want to read. He says, Balsack said the ideal was separate rooms, but if you share a room, you should share a bed. I don't know, Wendy, do you want to respond to Balzac?
Well, again, I think this should concept of anyone telling any couple what they should and should not do in their bedroom, is really not necessarily the best choice for an individual couple. Couples need to find what works for them, and there is not conclusive science to show that one thing is better than the other. We can have theories about why sleeping together may have some health benefits, but that still does not mean that it should be a prescription for all. And so, again, I think stepping away from this idea that there's one right way is really going to be what's more health. What's more healthful for couples. It's sort of like what David was just saying, that, sleep is a dynamic state. And, before the advent of light, we had these sort of periods of sleep, and there was wakefulness in the middle of it. Nowadays, we feel that it's so unnatural that if you wake up at 1 o'clock in the morning or 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock, there's almost immediately the sense of anxiety, that I should be, that sleep is a coma state, which it really is not. It's dynamic. We do wake up. And if you could just allow yourself to sort of be peaceful, to rest, and to fall back into sleep, we might be able to avoid these things like insomnia and leading to medication. And we might kind of reduce that anxiety of, oh, my gosh, I should be sleeping 8 hours solidly without ever waking up, just like kind of this idea that we should either, if we're in a room together, we should be sleeping together. It really needs to be less prescriptive than that.
And that's Wendy Troxell, who joins us along with David Randall. We are talking not just about sleeping, but the sleeping habits of couples, of partners. Some people sleep together. Some people start out together in the night and then troop off to different beds during the night. Some people sleep apart. We're talking about what this all means and some of the latest research about co-sleeping. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes at whyy.org, and send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Let me see what Mrs. F. from New Jersey has to say. Mrs. F., go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I'm really glad that you're having this discussion. My husband and I have been married for 25 years, and we have slept separately for 24, at least 24 of those years. And we're extremely happy. We're very close. The stories I've heard, particularly by women over the years, about not getting any sleep because of the issues in the bedroom with their partner, I just feel so bad for people, and I feel bad for myself because 99.9% of the people and family that we know we don't even discuss this with them because of the uncomfortable, you know, response you may get. And I think there's been more discussion lately of this issue, which is good, but I would just like to attest that we are extremely happy when we can, we spend time together, but with work schedules and sleeping habits, it just makes it impossible to get a good night's sleep.
I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And David, let me give you a chance to respond to her comments. And from her perspective, it just didn't work out that they slept together, but they're a happy couple.
I think that's a great point. I think the point, too, of saying, you know, it's hard to see other people's reactions to what we say. That's one thing scientists find is actually really hard to get good, solid data on how many people really do share a bed or not. Some people, you know, couples might say, we're going to say that we sleep together just because that feel like we should say that. That's what the data wants us. That's what the scientist wants us to hear. I think it's interesting, too, that especially with issue of a man and woman sharing a bed, men tend to snore more and then women tend to be lighter sleepers. So it's almost like biology has this dark joke that, you know, women have worse sleep, even though they're the ones who aren't necessarily suffering from sleep apnea. They're the ones suffering from the obvious effect of it, which is, you know, snoring. Whereas the, you know, person who has sleep apnea, it's harder to tell, oh, I'm just tired all the time. Maybe something else is going on. Maybe I'm just not exercising enough. And it's, you know, the fact is that sleep apnea is essentially nocturnal choking. And that's happened again and again throughout the night. And they just are never getting good and deep restful sleep. And then one other issue is that men tend to suffer from different, I guess, more extreme sleep disorders. One of them is known as REM sleep behavior disorder, which is essentially you act out your dreams. That most of us, when we're in REM sleep, your body's essentially paralyzed. So that's why you're not acting out everything in your head. If somebody has REM sleep behavior disorder, they really do. They're going to be, you know, flinging lamps across the room. They're going to be running around. You know, someone who spoke with me who has this condition, he spoke with saying, you know, I woke up terrified that I had my wife in a headlock.
Wow.
And that's a you know, that's not just, you know, do we have a close relationship or not? That's literally danger. So some people do sleep apart for so many reasons that have nothing to do with do I love you or not.
Let me, Wendy, read a Facebook comment. This is from Rosemary. She says, when I was young, I thought it was odd that my grandparents graduated to twin beds. Then she asked, do those Fitbit bands that calculate sleep patterns help? She's thinking about getting those. These bands give you information, I guess, about the quality of one's sleep. Do you suggest people get them?
So there's a lot of products on the market that are essentially activity monitors, like I was discussing before, which can provide a pretty good assessment of kind of the timing of your sleep and how efficient your sleep is. That is kind of how fragmented it is or how restful it is. Your sleep quality is really a subjective measurement of kind of how rested do you feel in the morning? Did you feel like it was a good quality sleep? So they're not going to measure that. Now, whether or not these things, quote unquote, help, I wouldn't say, you know, they're not a treatment in themselves. On the other hand, you know, knowledge is often, you know, powerful in terms of helping to create some new habits. And let's say you have a very irregular sleep schedule, and that's generally not recommended. Having that kind of activity monitor give you some data on how much you're sleeping on a night-to-night basis over an extended period of time, and also the timing of your sleep. Are you waking up at widely different times day to day? And are you suffering in your ability to fall asleep on a Sunday night, let's say? That can help kind of guide you to realize kind of one of the major recommendations that we as sleep clinicians will offer is that create a very consistent wake time routine. We're actually less focused on your bedtime, very much focused on your wake time, because that's what really sets that internal clock to know when is it daytime and when is it nighttime. So these devices can be very useful for giving you some of your own data on the sort of consistency or lack of consistency of your sleep schedule, and also it might help identify if you have a night that's really a poor night of sleep, then you might be able to look back in your day and say, well, what did I do differently this day? Mm-hmm. Was it a particularly stressful day at work? Did I have an argument with my spouse? Did I drink too much? Did I drink too much coffee? You know, you can kind of use that data to then introspect and kind of look back and see, okay, what are some factors that are interfering with my sleep?
David, let me put something else on the table here. And I remember when having a young child, the sort of musical beds that get played at nighttime when there are young children in the house. Can you speak to that?
I think that's a great point, too. You know, as somebody who has a three-year-old and a three-month-old at home.
Mm. You're living it, right?
Exactly. As soon as kids come into play, everything with sleep changes. You know, some people have really firm rules saying, you know, kids are never going to be in, and you know, the infants are never going to be in the bed. We're never going to share the bed with them. And some people, you know, say, you know, bring them on in. Let's have the baby in the bassinet next to us. And those are all different issues that really depend on so many things. You know, your work schedule, what your own sleeping cycle is like, how warm or cold you like it. It's very hard to say one size fits all.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking not just about sleeping, but couples and in certain instances, families sleeping together. And that's David Randall. He's the author of a book called Dreamland, Adventures in the Strange Science of Sleep. In fact, was a guest on Radio Times when that book was first published. He's currently senior reporter at Reuters, and he's written quite a bit about sleeping and separate beds and couples sleeping together. Also with us, Wendy Troxell, behavioral and social scientist at the RAND Corporation. She's an adjunct professor of psychiatry and psychology at the University of Pittsburgh across the state here in Pennsylvania, a licensed clinical psychologist, and a certified behavioral sleep medicine specialist. Calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. We are talking about sleeping and partners sharing or not sharing a bed. Does your partner snore at night and keep you awake? Do they watch TV while you want to have lights out at 10 o'clock? Does your bedmate like to keep the window open even though you need to pile on the quilts to stay warm? That's what we're talking about, and you can give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Here's another clip from a different TV show. This is from The Family Guy. The Griffins are having trouble sharing their bed and get advice of a sleep doctor. And Peter Griffin is voiced by Seth MacFarlane. Lois is voiced by Alex Borstein. Let's listen.
Well, Mrs. Griffin, you have 3 crushed ribs, but I was able to stop the internal bleeding.
Doctor, this has happened 7 times in the last month. Peter rolls over in his sleep and almost kills me.
I see. Well, that sucks.
Look, I don't do it on purpose.
Well, it looks like you got a handle on it then.
No, we don't. He practically smothers me every night.
Well, are you hogging the blankets?
No.
Another scene about sleeping together or not sleeping together from TV. Wendy, we have a tweet from Nathan saying, can having a large king-size bed be a solution to couples having problems sleeping together? What do you think about that?
Well, I think certainly having more physical space can help distribute, the bodies better and cause less interference. And it kind of allows them to have that shared space and yet also have their individual space. And for many couples, that's really a benefit. Now, clearly, though, just like in Victorian times and before, there are major socioeconomic factors that kind of influence whether or not we even have the choice to have a king-size bed. So certainly if you have the resources, I think for many couples, the shared space is definitely desired, but also having some ability to roll away is also a benefit.
I'm looking at an email from Michelle. I'll put this to you, David, just at the tail end. You were talking about lights and tablets and TVs and all the lights in people's rooms. She was just curious about her Kindle, which is backlit. Have you looked at that specifically?
Kindles actually are better. So I have a Kindle myself, and it's not the newest model, but it uses e-ink, so there's not actually a backlit illumination. It's when you have a tablet or, you know, an iPhone where it actually is the, you know, whitish blue light from the LED screen. That's much brighter. That's the light that your brain is going to think of as sunlight.
We have a Facebook comment from Lynette. I'll put this to you, Wendy. She says, this is an ongoing issue in our home. Chronic pain keeps me awake until the early morning. My husband is an amateur astronomer who is often getting up just when I'm finally falling asleep. At this point, there's a fair amount of arguing. My husband is a sleep mask for when I'm reading in bed. I just deal with him waking me at 4 a.m. I mean, it seems like they need some kind of intervention, Wendy. What do you say to Lynette?
Sure, Lynette. Well, I mean, I can certainly feel for her. And I mean, she's not alone in this. I mean, for many of the couples that I see, you know, it's this combination of factors. It's not just your partner interfering with your sleep, but she's already got a major strike against her, frankly. She's got chronic pain. And the chronic pain, I'm going to guess, is the major factor that's interfering with her ability to sleep. So certainly addressing the pain issues and perhaps also seeing a sleep specialist who might be able to help her with some behavioral strategies, both to manage the pain but also to improve the quality of her sleep. I mean, the fact that her husband has a different sleep schedule based on his occupation and also has a sleep disorder himself, these are all factors mm-hmm. that once she's sleeping poorly, you know, kind of her threshold for being awoken is so low to begin with that kind of, you know, anything would probably wake her up. I think that kind of managing her pain and getting some help for herself to help improve the quality of her sleep, including if that means sleeping apart from her partner for a time, if that works for them, that may be a solution. But I think that there's a lot of factors going on here. And the other thing I would say about this, we know that not only does chronic pain interfere with the quality of your sleep, but when you sleep poorly, your pain is exacerbated. Mm. So it's really this vicious cycle. So finding some inroad, and I think for many, treating the sleep disturbance can be a very useful inroad. She needs to break that cycle somehow. And yes, she's not alone. And this is kind of one of the reasons why I study sleep in couples. We also know that when you sleep poorly, your relationship can suffer. And when you're having a lot of conflict in your relationship, your sleep can suffer. So yet again, another vicious, cycle.
To you, David, and just picking up on that comment, which is that people just have so many different schedules, or at least they seem to have so many different schedules under the kind of stress of work or the stress of home and managing everything. I mean, in certain ways, it's no wonder so many people have so much trouble sleep and even couples sleeping together.
Exactly. So many couples, too, you know, there's different types of work. Not everybody goes to work at 9 to 5. And then comes home and wants to go to sleep at 10. So many people have, you know, shifts that change. You know, if you're a nurse, if you're a doctor, if you're a truck driver, if so many things that you might say, you know, the only time I really can sleep is from 1 a.m. to 10 in the morning, and we have to find a way to work around that. There's also the issue when you do share a bed with somebody, just the physical part of it, there's not just, you know, kicking and things like that. There's also the issue of temperature, that as you fall asleep, your body gives off a lot of heat, and that can be trapped in the mattress itself. It can be trapped in the covers. And that's another thing that can really drive some of these conversations is, you know, it's just so hot, I can't sleep next to this other person. What do I do?
Going back to you, Wendy, and even I was reading about oxytocin, and which has been called the love hormone. Is that enhanced by people sleeping together, touching each other, having sex together?
I would say the research is out on that. It's a hypothesis we have written about, and so oxytocin is this hormone that's produced in both men and women. It's called the love hormone because it's associated not only with physical intimacy and orgasm, but simply by being close with another person, just touch or massage, or being in the physical presence of someone that you feel very strongly about. And so one and what we know about oxytocin is that it has many health benefits. It can lower other stress hormones such as cortisol. So one theory is that by sleeping together and potentially by releasing more oxytocin, this might account for one of the reasons why healthy couples, couples with high-quality intimate relationships, why you know they tend to have better physical and mental health. But it's really more of a theory at this point, though we do know that oxytocin certainly has benefits for kind of can reduce anxiety and can also reduce stress hormones. So it's a possibility.
Something to look at. Let me get, it looks like Leslie from Swarthmore to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Leslie. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I wondered if anyone had thought about or talked about or looked at what happens when these sleep habits change. I slept with my husband for 28 years, and we slept in the same bed and just sort of never occurred to us to do anything else. Sometimes, you know, turned to opposite ways and sometimes spoon. Anyway, and we had different wake-up patterns. I was listening to that. He died 3 years ago, and I've been sleeping alone ever since. And just, it's taken me 3 years to become accustomed, I think, you know, to be accustomed to being alone in the bed. And my sleep pattern has changed hugely. I mean, just in the last couple of months, I'm sleeping incredibly deeply, which I never did. You know, sleeping in the same bed.
Well, it's a fascinating phone call, Leslie. I appreciate the call, and a very poignant one as well. And Wendy, since you're a psychologist, I do want to go back to you. And she very beautifully, I think, described her sleeping arrangement with her husband. Yeah. And now 3 years after he's died, her sleeping pattern is different and maybe even better. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, well, I'm very glad to hear that for her. And certainly, grief and bereavement, there is some research to show that, you know, when a partner dies, for some people, there's a significant increase in sleep disruptions, particularly if they have what's called unresolved grief. And particularly in the immediate aftermath. What's also true is research that's shown that kind of in other types of relationship ruptures, for instance, with divorce, when people are going through the process of divorce, as compared to when the divorce is actually finalized, their sleep is much more disrupted. So I think that really echoes what she's saying, which is that there was this time of bereavement where the body is just adjusting both behaviorally and probably, you know, there are probably some direct effects physiologically that she used to have when sleeping with a partner that, you know, the partner was no longer there, and certainly psychologically, but kind of that she's kind of gotten through that and now is actually sleeping better. And that's wonderful to hear. And it is consistent with, you know, we don't like transitions and they, you know, relationship changes for various reasons are one of the most stressful things that we ever experience. And yes, it manifests directly in our sleep until it resolves.
Les, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. David, anything you want to add to that?
I think that was a great point. So much of sleep, you know, you can think of it as a mood ring for the body. You know, people who are suffering from depression, their sleep patterns are going to be much markedly different than they were before. It could either be someone who's not sleeping whatsoever, or someone who finds himself sleeping deeply, and you know they feel like they can't get out of bed after 12 hours. And that some of that's connected with sleep, and some of it's connected with, you know, just the effects of depression. But so many parts of your life really is it all comes down to you see it all in sleep.
And does it also come down to having a good mattress, David?
That's actually one thing I was really surprised by, that there's actually very little research that suggests that any type of mattress is better for sleep. What it comes down to is that whatever you're comfortable with. So if you're somebody who has slept on a firm mattress forever and suddenly you have a pillow top, you're going to find it not comfortable. And it might take a while to adjust to it. And this research was done actually by some scientists in Germany who were trying to find the exact perfect bed for everybody in a hospital to sleep on. And they found that there was absolutely no correlation between one type or a body type or another.
Interesting. Let me get, looks like Claire from Warwick, Pennsylvania, to join us. Hi, Claire. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Yes, Marty. Thank you for taking my call.
Of course.
This is an issue that I don't think has been covered during this program. My husband and I sleep in different rooms. He snores. And this has been a long time. We're married 61 years. Our issue right now is that we love to travel. And wherever we travel, we have to get two separate sleeping quarters, and that becomes very, very expensive. And that's an issue that I, you know, can he talk about that? Has that been something that's been talked about?
Well, not on this show, Claire, but let me see if Wendy wants to weigh in on that. Wendy, what do you think?
Yeah, well, I think it's a great point, and I would start thinking about kind of adding up those dollars that you're having to dole out to have separate bedrooms while you travel. And I would certainly think about kind of using that as a, what's the motivation? Is your to motivate your husband? Is he getting treatment? Has he been diagnosed with a sleep disorder? Has he had a sleep study? If he has sleep apnea, he needs to be treated. This is a significant health problem. Snoring is not just a nuisance to your sleep. It can really be a sign of a significant physical health condition. If it's not a sleep apnea, does he have other risk factors for just simple snoring, like being overweight? If that's the case, again, I would think about this as being a motivator to help him to lose weight, increase physical activity, change some dietary habits. There's also other behavioral things he might want to try to reduce the snoring, such as there are certain bed pillows that can help him sleep on his side if it's more of a positional snoring. But for many people, snoring is a symptom of a significant sleep disorder. So I would use that as the push to get in to see the doctor.
Claire, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. We don't have time to take Jerry's call, but I'll put this to you, David. He wants to know, on melatonin, can they talk about the benefits of this and its impact on sleep? Can you address the melatonin issue?
Well, melatonin is a hormone that essentially helps you fall asleep. Some people try, opt for taking a melatonin pill before sleep, as opposed to an Ambien. One issue, though, that, I found while working on the book is that people tend to take it way too late, that, it takes a while for melatonin to be absorbed into the bloodstream. So if you're going to take it, you should take it, 5 or 6 in the evening if you're going to fall asleep at 10 or 11 or so.
Wendy, 30 seconds.
Yeah, what I would say is melatonin is really generally not a sedative, so it's not going to really help you fall asleep necessarily. But what it can do for people, it really helps to shift your schedule, but its timing is everything, and many people do take it at the wrong time. So it can be useful when dealing with jet lag or if you're trying to shift your sleep-wake schedule, but you probably want to ask a doctor about it so that you can optimize the timing and make it really work for you.
Wendy, I'm curious, are you a good sleeper? You're a sleep researcher. Are you a good sleeper?
I am a good sleeper in general, and I also know what to do when I'm not sleeping well. So when I have a lot of stress in my life, I'm like everybody else. I don't sleep as well, but I don't lie in bed and stew. I get out of bed, I do something relaxing and boring, basically, until I feel sleepy again, and then I return to bed.
Well, I thank you for joining us today on Radio Times. Wendy Troxell, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And she's a licensed clinical psychologist, certified behavioral sleep medicine specialist. David Randall, thank you very much as well.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And he's the author of Dreamland, also a senior reporter at Reuters. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of the show. Quinn Libsen is our intern. The show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and we want to close things out with a song from Barbara Mandrell.
Sleeping single in a double bed.